It's a new day. At the Freedom Station, WFYL is working for your liberty, presenting news with no spin.
Thought-provoking. A local commentary. Your opinion matters.
Put the power back in the hands of the people.
Endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's a new day.
Good morning, and welcome to It's a New Day. It's a very special edition of It's a New Day here at the Freedom Station. We've turned WFYL into a public house today for a voyage of discovery into the law of the land. And that would be the Constitution of the United States. We've been promoting this for a few days now, and as we say, and as John Adams said, this is a government of laws and not of men. My name is Andrew Turner.
And I'm Bruce Stocky.
And I have Bruce here as well. As I said, today is the Freedom Station. We turned WFYL into a public house, and we'll be talking the Constitution all day today, won't we, Bruce?
We will indeed.
So we have with us today quite a number of guests. We'll be starting out this morning with David Whitney, as well as Patrick Coker, Sam Rohr, Chuck Proctor, and Roger Howard. And we'll be going through a number of different topics that are important to us today, and it should be important to the rest of us as well. Right before the show, we had a small prayer, and as we said, you know, these are things that everyone needs to know, and these are things that we hope can guide us through these hard times. So I'll lay out a little bit of the format this morning that we're going to be going through, and that'll be, well, Bruce, what are we looking for today?
Well, what we're looking for today is a kind of a little bit of a living history, a recreation here. Is that we're calling this WFYL's public house. It's the Freedom Station Forum on the Constitution of the United States, and we're hearkening back to the days, and we use this title of a public house because this country was actually developed in what would be known as a public house, where such places like the Green Dragon, which was a public house in Boston where the Sons of Liberty met to talk about this radical insurrection of leaving the crown, creating their own country. And then here in Philadelphia, once that war of independence was won, they met in what is now known as Constitutional Hall. It was the public, it was the state house for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And then they would go over to places like the City Tavern and talk about their ideas. And ideas were freely exchanged in these public houses. Mm. And we're going to revisit that, go back to our roots, and talk about various matters. And the matters that we're going to deal with are such things as the mandates. David Whitney will be discussing that. In fact, we'll be talking to him on the phone. Patrick Coker's here. He'll be talking about the Bill of Rights. And we have Sam Rohr, who is here. First Amendment, freedom of religion. And, of course, one that it's a hot topic that I always get on, this notion of separation of church and state. Charles Proctor is here. Fifth Amendment, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, also known as the Commerce Clause. And Roger Howard, 15th Amendment, election and voting fraud, and your rights there. These are your basic laws and rights of the United States Constitution that we're going to be delving into.
And diving into it.
Yeah, so many people have looked at the Constitution over the years and the legal ease and how attorneys have gone and just taken the document and created it into something in their interpretation that is unrecognizable by Americans. The Constitution of the United States was written for the farmer, the shopkeeper, could pick it up and read it and understand it. And we hope to recapture that mode today and bring it back to that time period and give a clearer understanding of what this document, this is the law of the land and how it applies to all Americans and how we should be on guard about our liberties, our rights, our freedoms being slowly whittled away by those officials that we hire to represent us in this representative government that we have.
And we've talked to all of you individually, and I can say it is such a pleasure to have all of you in the same room together to discuss these constitutional issues with us. And as Bruce said, we do have David Whitney, who will be calling us from D.C. He's on the phone with us right now, and he is down attending the Wall Builders Conference. And we're sorry he couldn't be here, but we're absolutely pleased to have him on the phone with us right now. So I'd like to welcome Pastor David Whitney to the program. Pastor, thank you so much for being able to call us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's my privilege. It's a great blessing to be able to talk with people who really care about their country, care about what's happening, and want to see a solution, really a solution that goes back to a very simple question. Do words mean what they were designed to mean by those who put them to paper at the very first? In other words, if we can make the words mean whatever we want, we don't have a government, we have a tyranny. We have a group of people who decide what the rules are, and it's kind of like if you're playing a card game, you want to play a game of poker with somebody that every hand after the hand's dealt and after you've begun to look at your cards, all of a sudden the rules are changed by this person who's in charge of all the rules. That's essentially what we have in Washington, D.C. Today, Obama says one thing about the Obamacare. Tomorrow it'll be something different, and the day after that something else, and you never know what it's going to be next. And this just reminds us of a kind of tyrannical government that is the opposite of exactly what our founders designed for us. You know, when we talk about the Constitution, a lot of people say, well, you know, the courts and the judges, they're the ones that tell us what the meaning of those words are, and that's a lie. That's exactly the opposite of what our founders designed. They said, this is what the words mean that they put to paper, and they've spent a great deal of time and energy explaining that to us, things like the Federalist Papers, things like their own writings, things like commentaries on the Constitution written by those who were there in the founding era. They can give us an understanding of what those words mean. I liken it to if you go to your tool shop and you want to get a good grip on some item. Say you got a bolt that you want to hold on to that you know is going to be tough to grasp. If you just hold on to it with your bare hands, you know that that bolt is probably going to rip your flesh up. It's going to cause you to bleed and give you a lot of pain. So you look for a tool to get a hold of that that bolt, and a vice grip is probably one of the best tools to do that. So you clamp that vice grip down upon that bolt, and now with your bare hands, using that vice grip, you can get a great hold on that bolt, and no matter how hard that bolt turns, you can prevent it from turning in a way that you don't want it to. And I liken that to what our Constitution is. It's like a pair of vice grips that we, the people, with our bare hands, can get a hold of that bolt, which is the government that we created through those founding documents, through our Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, Bill of Rights. The government we created, we get a hold on it, and we control it, and we keep it from moving in a direction that either will be damaging to us or a direction we don't want it to go. That vice grip, and I'm glad later on in the show you're going to talk about Article 1, Section 8, because I liken that to the jaws of the vice grip, where the actual contact takes place between the control we the people have designed and the government that we designed it to control. Now, if you want to take an opposite image of that, because that's really what's happened in Washington, D.C. today, my kids, they often got these little pills that are a little capsule size of a vitamin pill, but when you open it up, inside there's this little teeny sponge. But take that sponge and you put it in a glass of water, and an amazing thing happens. That sponge expands and expands and expands and soaks up all the water in the glass to a point that it fills the glass. And you liken that to liberty being the water. What the government in Washington, D.C. today is like that sponge. It soaks up every ounce of liberty of we the people. And that's the opposite of our founders' design, to control the government. The government does its job description given to it in the Constitution. Instead, we have a government defining its own Constitution on a day-by-day basis, doing what it pleases, and we the people really have very little control over it. I know that We elect representatives go down to the House and the Senate, but those representatives seem to get inside the Beltway, and wow, everything changes. They're not the same people we sent down there, and certainly they don't seem to represent us very well, likewise in the executive branch. But our founders knew the danger of allowing uncontrolled power in the hands of those that we elect to represent us. So they constructed that Constitution in a series of ways to prevent them from ever gaining the kind of power and taking that kind of control that we see them doing today. So the question is, what happened? What, you know, where did it go wrong? And I'd liken it to, think of the last time you took your car down to the repair shop to have some work done on it. Maybe you just needed an oil change and, you know, change the spark plugs and oil. So when you were about to walk out the door of that repair shop, I'm sure they didn't let you go until you signed a document. And that document with your signature at the bottom told the repair shop specifically what it could do. Okay, it's going to change the oil, it's going to change the spark plugs. And that document limits them to just doing those things specified in the document. Now, there might have been a whole lot of fine print on that document. You didn't take the time to read and so forth. But if that document was done correctly, that contract between you and your repair shop is a fixed document. If you come back at the end of the day, instead of just those two items, say they, you know, change your transmission, and now the bill is $5,000, and you're outraged, rightly outraged. You're like, wait a minute, I'm not going to pay for this. I did not agree to do this in the contract. And the shop owner's got a problem because he amended the contract without your permission. And likewise with our Constitution, there is a way to amend the contract, but it must be by the process designed in the Constitution, which involves the permission of the people to amend that contract. Instead, what's happened in Washington, D.C. is the court amends the contract anytime they please. Legislative branch amends the contract. And certainly we've seen the executive branch just in spades amending that contract willy-nilly any way they please without the signature of we the people,
David,
without our permission. And therefore, you'd say, wait a minute, the contract in that case, like the repair ban, the contract is a broken contract. And we the people, in a sense, are under no obligation to obey and to follow pieces of that contract that have been illegally amended, and we need to set it right. The problem is most Americans have never read the contract. Just like a lot of people, when they sign off at the dotted line there with the repair service, they don't read the fine print in the contract. And if they don't, well, there could be a lot of trouble if they signed on to something they don't understand.
Well, David,
so it's vitally important,
David,
for us to restore liberty in America, that Americans get back to studying the contract, not according to what the judges today tell us it means, but according to what the founders themselves said that contract meant.
David,
it's not hard to find. It's very clear.
David, this is Bruce Stocking. I'd like to welcome you to the program. And
thank you.
And you know what you're describing there is exactly right. And of course, we deal with the subject nowadays of mandate, which in the Constitution does not provide that the government can mandate you to purchase anything. And so I think it was you in one of our past interviews that we were talking about there, where you mentioned when a mandate comes in, liberty is lost.
That's right. Exactly so.
And so we'll pick up on that point again as we move right along. And we have yet another individual who's in studio with us today, Patrick Coker. Patrick Coker is an expert on the Bill of Rights of the Constitution. And of course, Patrick, a lot of people don't know what the Bill of Rights are. We hear this, and they look for it in the Constitution and the various publications. You don't see it down as Bill of Rights. What is the Bill of Rights?
Sure. The Bill of Rights, it's the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. And the reason there are amendments is really important to understand why they're there and what they're doing. There was a lot of debate when the Constitution was being written over the need for Bill of Rights. Almost all of your Federalist supporters of the Constitution very much opposed the idea of a Bill of Rights. But they did this because of the purpose of the Constitution. They saw a Bill of Rights as something that was necessary in a monarchy to counteract royal prerogative and say, you may not do these certain things even though you're the king. But the purpose of the Constitution was to provide a limiting framework for the entire operation and reach of the federal government. So they didn't believe that there was a need for a Bill of Rights, because if it wasn't written in the Constitution, the federal government couldn't do it, very simply. And in fact, several of them argued that a Bill of Rights would be dangerous because it would allow future generations possibly to be sold the idea that a Bill of Rights was a comprehensive list of restrictions on the federal government, rather than Article 1, Section 8 being a comprehensive list of powers.
Mm-hmm.
So Alexander Hamilton, for example, he said, why declare that things shall not be done which there is no power to do? That's in Federalist 84. And Randolph, John Jay, Madison, lots of them really went to the American people making this argument that a Bill of Rights would be a problem.
And, of course, when you're referring to Federalists, you're talking the Federalist Papers.
Well, the Federalist was a catch-all term that meant supporters of the Constitution when it was being pushed. The anti-Federalists were those who opposed the Constitution because they felt it gave the federal government too much power.
Mm-hmm.
So the Federalist Papers were written by Jay, Madison, and Hamilton, three of the most well-spoken Federalists who were very gifted in writing, and they got together to try and convince the American people that this was a necessary thing. But ultimately, they capitulated on the point of the Bill of Rights because there was too much fear in the general public that this Constitution gave the federal government too much power, and they realized something had to be done to build confidence. So in response to this demand, particularly Madison, who we often refer to as the father of the Bill of Rights, even though he initially opposed one, he agreed to support a series of amendments to the Constitution. That's the first 10, and that's what we call the Bill of Rights. The first 8 of these are very specific. For example, the First Amendment was designed to prevent the federal government from asserting control over your conscience, communication, information, to make sure that there was absolute freedom in that regard. Second and Third Amendments were to prevent the government from using the military to coerce the people. And that's not a very politically correct thing to say today, but that's exactly what they were there for.
Mm-hmm.
The next 5 are all about law enforcement, the judicial system. They're designed to prevent the misuse of legal processes, ensure that innocent people are protected, that an accused person is treated as innocent until proven guilty. And the last 2 are really there to guard against the concern that the Federalists had. Their purpose is to make sure that a Bill of Rights did not open the door to an overly broad interpretation of power. So we have the 9th Amendment. I guess I should read it because I can't quite quote it, but the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And the 10th Amendment, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. That was to answer the concerns of the Federalists over what this Bill of Rights could do and the open interpretation that they feared it could lead to. Interestingly, most people don't know what the 10th Amendment is, and right. It has led to exactly what the Federalists are.
Yeah, it's just like First Amendment, where a lot of people spout it, but they don't know exactly what it means on there. And, of course, with the rights, another thing I think a lot of people misunderstand with this is that our rights are given to us by God, and not by a law, not by the Constitution. And, to get that point across, that no man gives us rights. The Almighty gave us rights.
That's exactly right. And that gets to the what we'll be talking about later. You asked the question, how do we get back on track? And, I'm really passionate about specifically waking up evangelical Christians to take their freedom and their faith seriously both, because I really believe as Americans we've abandoned our legal foundations, our history, and more importantly, our moral compass. And we've replaced objective morality that comes from the Creator who endowed us with certain inalienable rights with just a subjective morality, where whatever our cultural inclinations are give us a framework of ethics in which to work. We have no guiding principle other than that we're great stuff, and that's not a very good one. Example of this, Mitt Romney in 2012, speaking at VMI, he called for a new set of bedrock principles to guide our foreign policy, and he articulated his principles. He said America must have confidence in our cause, clarity in our purpose, and resolve in our might. Problem is, Gene Healy commented in the Examiner, those are attitudes, not principles.
That's a good point. Very good point.
They refer only to ourselves. We're the standard. And you compare that to Abraham Lincoln, who said, God is my witness that it is my constant anxiety and prayer that both myself and this nation should be on the Lord's side.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different attitude. And it's not Mitt Romney. It's our entire It's our entire culture, and frankly, it's even in the church.
Right, right. And so you know, and this is something that, of course, in our second hour, we'll delve into more.
Absolutely.
With this type of subject on here. But I wanted to clarify very much what these Bill of Rights are, because they're not easily found if you're just looking for Bill of Rights, and that they are amendments. And what was the idea of amendments to begin with?
Well, the Constitution was designed to be able to be changed. They made it a very difficult process on purpose because they knew how much trouble they had had writing this document and getting everyone from all the different diverse interest groups represented by the different states to agree on a framework of government. They knew that it wasn't perfect, and they wanted it to be not set in stone, but they assumed that it would be respected, mm-hmm. and therefore there needed to be a way to change it if something okay. needed to be changed. That was the purpose of the amendment process. And those first 10, as I said before, were simply to guard against federal overreach.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. Okay. Well, what we're going to do is we are going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to be talking to Sam Rohr. And Sam will be talking about the First Amendment and religious freedom. Then we're going to hear from Charles Proctor that'll deal with the Fifth Amendment. And we may dabble into some things like the Commerce Clause and so forth. And then Roger Howard will be here, and we'll be talking 15th Amendment. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back to you. This is our constitutional special on It's a New Day here. At 1180 a.m. WFYL, we're calling this our public house.
We are, yeah.
And this is a little bit of a recreation of the discussions that were taking place in those early days of the founding of this country that were gathered around the various public houses, and which an exchange of ideas and thoughts that would transpose later into the Federalist Papers and would eventually come into our founding documents, the Articles of Confederation that would turn into the Constitution of the United States, that would then be brought into the Bill of Rights.
And in our second hour, Bruce, we'll be really diving in with our panel to really flesh out a lot of these issues. We're going to set them all up now, and then we're going to have a large discussion all together in the
right.
second hour. So first, just as important as the second. So we hope you stick around for all of that. You know, as Bruce said, we are diving into the Constitution headfirst. So we hope you're enjoying it. And as he also said, when we come back, we'll be talking with Sam Rohr on First Amendment rights, freedom of religion, and that sort of thing. So stick around. We will be right back right after this commercial break. So.
Working for your liberty right here in Philadelphia. Broadcasting freedom shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom shining light from Philly to the nation. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYL.
And welcome back to It's a New Day here at 1180 AM WFYL and our special constitutional issue of the public house. And this is a voyage of discovery into the law of the land, the Constitution of the United States. And I am just honored to be in studio with such a collection of individuals, patriots all, and on the phone, David Whitney on the phone. This is just an amazing event that's taking place here at our studios. And our next guest is Sam Rohr, president of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network. Sam, welcome to the program. And you're going to be talking about the First Amendment, freedom of religion, and various items that falls under the First Amendment. So state your case, Counselor.
Right. Bruce, glad to do that, and that's great to be a part of the panel this morning, and I appreciate the emphasis that is being placed by WFYL here on this most important area. You know, if you don't have the foundation properly established, you can't build the walls. And Scripture says that when the foundations are destroyed, what shall the righteous do? When we witness the tearing down of the very structures of a free republic such as we have, people are all across this country beginning to understand that things are changing, but they don't know enough about how it was that we got where we are in order to properly defend it. And that's what I think this is all about this morning. I think it's a great thing. I'm going to look at first the First Amendment just briefly here. And I think it would be appropriate for them to just take and read it. Because, again, as we already have talked, most people have not read the Constitution. Matter of fact, on the floor of the House in the past sessions when I was there, we actually asked one time on the floor, how many folks have you actually read the Constitution? We got about a dozen hands put up, literally. So this is a real issue. Let me read the First Amendment here so we all have an understanding of what it is. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or abridging the freedom of the press or the abridging of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, we often tend to think of the First Amendment, right, as the that which is gives us religious freedom, and in fact, it does. One thing I'd like to do, though, is just look at just a couple of things. When we talk about anything, it's best to define the terms. We're talking about rights here. The definition of right is a just claim. And so we understand that these rights that we're talking here are things that are established in our Declaration of Independence, are God-given rights, effectively, that are embodied within these things. Number one, it talks here about Congress not abridging any of these rights. To abridge means to simply lessen in any regard, to lessen that just claim, to weaken, to compromise, to in any way make it of none of anything that's not a full effect. It talks about here the right of the people to, I'll get into this later with reference to grievances and redressing, but note what's here first of all. Number one, this is a limitation on Congress. We've already heard from Patrick, who just mentioned the overall purpose of the Bill of Rights is to, you know, put some limitation on government. This is specifically here, says Congress shall make no law that takes and makes any change to these important areas. It's not that it's giving a go-ahead to the executive branch or it's giving a go-ahead to the judicial branch. But it says there shall be no law made to make these changes. Now, what is it? What's it? What are they not to address or to affect? One is that government, Congress, shall not make any kind of a law that puts government in a position of establishing an official religion. They mean a denomination. They're not talking here. It says government shall not say God's name or do anything to promote the concept of God. That was an underlying assumption that was clearly here. The whole thing was based on God's word and moral principles. That was the whole basis for it. They were not saying that. But they were saying that government was not to establish a denomination such as the Church of England that they were talking about at that point. So that's number one. Number two, they were not to prohibit in any way to forbid or to make illegal in any way the ability of citizens to openly practice the tenets of their belief in God and their exercise of their religion. They're not to tell them that they could not practice in public. This is not a private thing, as we're often hearing today. Well, you can believe what you want to in private. Don't talk about it publicly. This is not. This is a public fashion. You're not to limit that. Number three, this also protects the freedom of speech generally, not just religious speech, but all speech. It was very, very important to our founders that there was a free and open discourse that was allowed on all issues, and that was critically important for any kind of a free society. So this was a protection to not to be a limitation of any kind of freedom of speech, so we can go and talk about what we want to talk about. Then the next was the freedom of the press. This is covered in this area. The press was an extraordinarily important aspect for keeping freedom. Generally, the press needed to be able to have a free hand to write about what government was doing, what it was saying, and to be able to put forth the wishes of the people. That could not, they said, be abridged. And I think in all these cases, we know that they are being abridged, as we know well. But the other was that the right of the people to peaceably assemble. This is another major, major issue in a free society. If people do not have the ability to gather publicly for peaceably, and this is, then put it in peaceably, it's not for rioting purposes, it's for peaceably, to, in order to be able to express what they believe and maybe gather in front of the courthouse, maybe gather in front of Congress in order to relay what they want. This is that they could do that. And then the last one was, and this is something that's not often viewed, is that the right of the people here is protected to actually put a petition to basically inform those in government of things that are not going right. And it literally means a grievance is that which causes grief or uneasiness, that which burdens or oppresses or injures. It's implying a sense of wrongdoing. There's actually an element here that allows people to actually go in before those in office and say, there are things that are happening that are unjust, that are unwrong, and I need you to be able to hear. This is very seldom practiced. I saw it practiced once when I was in Pennsylvania House. Number of times people brought in things that were actually properly put together as a petition for grievance, and they were summarily dismissed by governor's council and by committee chair. They say, we don't even know what this is. We're not even going to respond to it. A very, very undercutting of this very thing that's put before it here. So the First Amendment certainly bears down on the freedom of religion. We can talk about how that is being so terribly misunderstood and misapplied. But really, it is that all of this public expression that is protected under the First Amendment, and really we are seeing tremendous injuries given to this in our society today.
Thank you. Thank you, Sam. I tell you, the second hour of this program is just going to explode with the information that's coming out here. And the way it's being related to the fact where this is their words, the Constitution itself, their meanings of these words, what they actually mean. And to continue this, we're now going to Charles Proctor. You've been busy.
Just a little, Bruce. It's been a wild 18 months, that's for sure.
I can tell. Charles Proctor has been representing the Conestoga Wood Specialties in front of the Supreme Court in the suit against Conestoga Wood Specialties against Kathleen Sebelius, and it has to deal with the Obama administration's mandate in what I like to call the Unaffordable Health Care Act, requiring them to provide abortion pills and so forth to their employees with their against. And Chuck is here to talk about it'd be the Fifth Amendment and Commerce Clause and various other things. So have at it, Counselor.
Well, Bruce, thanks so much. What I'd like to do is tell you a story about the Hahn family. But first, let me lay a foundation. And I'm going to go all the way back to the Declaration of Independence, where it says that our Creator endowed us with certain inalienable rights, namely life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And in today's society, I think too many people think of the pursuit of happiness as doing something that makes you feel good. That's not what our founders had in mind. The pursuit of happiness was the ownership of land that you could farm, or the ownership of a business that you could run so that you could feed and support your family. That was the pursuit of happiness. Today, that concept has been lost, and we have people thinking that it's an entirely something else. It's what makes you feel good, and that's not the case here. That's not what our founders had in mind. Now, let's flip over to the Fifth Amendment, and let's talk about what starts out talking about capital punishment and what have you, but in the end of the that amendment, it says, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall property be taken for public use, which refers to eminent domain, that type of thing. And due process means that we all have our day in court, and our day in court is so important to our society. The ability, as Sam was saying earlier, to petition for grievances. And quite often they're summarily dismissed. As President Obama has recently said, irrespective of what the House of Representatives and the Senate does, he's going to use his pen and his telephone to just override our rights. And that's not right. in the Commerce Clause, we're really looking at a section of the main body of the Constitution, it enumerates the powers that the federal government can engage in. And in some respects, the legal scholars have done a lot of parsing of the language in there and what Congress and the executive branch can or cannot do. But the kind of catch-all that the founders put in there was to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Now, what's happened here with the Affordable Care Act, I'm going to make it real for you. I'm going to make it very personal and talk about a family in Lancaster County that in 1964 started a business. It'll be 50 years in July, Bruce, since the Hawns started a woodworking business in the garage behind their house. Norman Hawn and his brother had been engaged in woodworking, and they wanted to do their own thing. And they incorporated. But at that time when they incorporated, they weren't thinking about religious freedom. They weren't thinking about exercise of their free speech or religious rights. They were thinking about, number one, the fact that it gave you a little protection from liability, and number two, tax issues, such as it being a sub-S corporation, which Conestoga Wood is. And sub-S corporation means that the profits and losses pass through directly to the shareholders, the owners of the company. Well, since that humble beginning in that garage, which I have had the privilege of seeing, the company has grown to over 1,000 employees today. And during that time, the Hawns have provided excellent benefits for their employees, including a very generous, a very comprehensive health plan. But because of their sincerely held religious beliefs, which they have adhered to their entire life, which they've been raised in and believed in completely, they are against any form of death, whether it's capital punishment, whether it's war, or whether it's abortifacient contraceptives. And by abortifacient, I mean a contraception that kills an embryo, a fertilized embryo. And the mandate put down by the Health and Human Services Department includes Plan B and Ella and intrauterine devices that kill fertilized embryos. And it's interesting that that mandate is not part of the legislation. That mandate is rather something created as or authorized by the ACA, and the Health and Human Services Department put it together. They're the ones that put it out. It is not part of the actual legislation, and it's what we call a regulation in the law. Well, the Hawns, when they found out that this was going to be implemented into their new insurance plan when it renewed, were quite upset. And they contacted Michael Gere at the Pennsylvania Family Institute, and at that time, Michael Gere and Randy Wenger from the Independence Law Center contacted me, and we got to work on this. And we were up against some deadlines time-wise because of the way the mandate was worded, and we filed in the Federal District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. And interestingly enough, Bruce, when we filed, we got a call from the judge. He wanted to have a conference call about this. We had our conference call. And you know what the judge said to us?
What was that?
Gentlemen, I don't know a thing about this. And I'm going on vacation in 2 weeks. And what are we going to do about it? Well, we eventually got our briefs filed and had our oral argument. He did give us a brief stay during that time frame. But he ruled against us. We took an appeal to the Third Circuit. And again, the Third Circuit lost, and finally, in what may be record-setting fashion, filed our petition to the Supreme Court, and were granted a writ of certiorari. That means permission to have an oral argument in front of the Supreme Court in less than a year from the date we filed our complaint, which is almost unheard of.
It's a quick turnaround.
Very quick. Now, the Hawns, during this whole thing, their concern was they wanted to provide insurance for their employees. They wanted to stay competitive in the marketplace, but they did not want to provide these abortifacient contraceptions, particularly when 180 million people, and that's by the government's own admission, were exempt from the mandate. And that is just almost inconceivable that through various means, whether you had a grandfathered insurance plan or whether a exemption was granted by the administration or what have you, 180 million people didn't have to comply, but the Hawns were. If they didn't comply, and this is the part that became just unbearable, they were faced with a $100 per employee per day fine, or over $100,000 per day, $36 million per year, a ruinous fine. In other words, a burden on their religious conscience, a choice between do we violate a religious conscience or do we go out of business. The government argued at the Supreme Court that, well, if you don't comply, you can not have an insurance plan, which reduces their competitiveness in the marketplace, and pay a $2,000 fine, which to me is a very subtle attempt, although maybe not so subtle, to implement the government's intrusion into supplying health care for everyone as opposed to letting the Hawns do it themselves. And in the case of Yoder in Wisconsin, which is a very famous case, it was an Amish family, and they had not sent their son to public school, and they were fined $5. It was a $5 fine. And the government in that case said, the Supreme Court said in that case, the least intrusion on your religious conscience for the shortest period of time is too much, and they upheld the Yoder's right not to be fined and not to send their son to public school. Here we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars worth of fines for violating religious conscience on an ongoing basis. And I might add that the Hawns, since that time, have been complying with the mandate and obeying the government in this regard. And that's why we're hopeful that the Supreme Court will give them relief for their religious conscience.
Chuck, that's an amazing story on, insight into all this which is going on here. Again, another threat to our liberties and our rights and our freedoms that we have. So, more to follow on this one. Our next guest is Roger Howard. Roger Howard is a Republican candidate for Pennsylvania State House of Representatives from District 158. And Roger, welcome to the program, and you're going to be stating the case for the 15th Amendment.
Thanks very much, Bruce, and thanks for having me this morning. I thought the title here is voter fraud, voter ID. And the underlying principle is, we often hear one man, one vote. More clearly stated is one qualified citizen, one vote. So since this is about the Constitution, we ought to start off and say who gets to vote and what does the Constitution have to say about it. Well, first, in Article 1, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, it says that electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature. Now, electors means qualified voters. So here, the Constitution says that who gets to vote is up to the states. And that phrase is repeated later in the 17th Amendment. So this is a current concept in the Constitution. Okay, so then the next issue comes that at various times the Constitution has been amended so that there are restrictions on who can be prevented from voting, right? So the 15th Amendment, which was ratified in 1870, says that vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. The 19th Amendment says that the vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. That was passed in 1920. And then the 24th Amendment, which was passed in 1964, says that the vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay a poll tax. And lastly, the 26th Amendment says that the right of citizens of the United States who are 18 years of age or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of age. So here we have a set of conditions. The Constitution has defined who gets to vote. So since the states get to define who gets to vote, let's take a look at the Pennsylvania Constitution. Article 7, Elections, Section 1, Qualification of Electors. Every citizen 21 years of age possessing the following qualifications shall be entitled to vote at all elections, subject, however, to such laws requiring and regulating the registration of electors as the General Assembly may enact. He or she shall have been a citizen of the United States at least 1 month. He or she shall have resided in the state 90 days immediately preceding the election. He or she shall have resided in the election district where he or she shall offer to vote at least 60 days immediately preceding the election. All right, so now, if we have a law saying who gets to vote, then shouldn't we need to identify those people who get to vote? Because not everyone gets to vote as defined by our Constitution, right? We know there's voter fraud. Now, people would say there isn't voter fraud, but I want to point out four sources of voter fraud. Two books by John Fund of the Wall Street Journal, Stealing Elections, published in 2008, Who's Counting, published in 2012. Many of you saw on TV and on the Internet Project Veritas by James O'Keefe, where he showed videos of people in the process of being able to commit voter fraud, to vote for people who had passed away. And, of course, very recently you heard about a project in which North Carolina found that there were a large number of people who were registered both in North Carolina and in other states. So 28 states participated in this audit, and the audit showed that there were 155,692 registered North Carolina voters whose first and last names, dates of birth, and last four digits of their Social Security numbers matched those of voters registered in other states, but who most recently registered or voted elsewhere. Okay, so that brings us down to voter fraud. Here's the absolute proof of voter fraud. You don't have to get lost in the weeds here. The absolute proof is that if you go door to door, and I have done this recently to get signatures for my own petitions, and I have done it in the last 3 years, well, actually since 2006, many times. I've been to thousands of doors. It's very common to find that the voter rolls of the state include a large number of people who simply aren't there anymore. So this is not a fault of the state. This is federal law. This is the National Voting Rights Act and the Pennsylvania Voting Rights Act, which mirrors the federal law. And that law says that you can't be removed from the voter rolls until you have been inactive, that is, not voting for 5 years. And at that period of time, voter services sends you a letter. Of course, it sends the letter to where you are not. And if you don't respond to that letter, then they have to wait for two federal general elections, that's four more years, before they can remove you from the rolls. So this guarantees that if you move out of your voting district and do not send a letter to Chester County Voter Services, in my case, then you're going to be on the rolls for 9 years. When you go door to door, you'll find that at least 5% of the people on that list aren't there, just aren't there. So when Palm Beach County reports 102% of a vote, when Philadelphia reports 100% of the vote, or when the state of Washington in the election of a former governor, Christine Gregoire, eventually finds enough votes that they have more than 100% participation, you know there's voter fraud, because 5% of those people simply aren't there. So that's the absolute proof of it. The question is what to do about it. And this is the point of voter ID. And the real point of voter ID is not to prevent people from voting, but to be sure that one man, one vote is not only the law of the land, but the practice of the land. This is absolutely essential to our liberty. And in the Constitution, the United States Constitution, in Article 4, Section 4, it says that the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government. So they're not only saying that you get to vote, they're saying that you're going to be in a government where you are allowed to vote by its structure.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Roger, for giving us that voter ID, and all of our panelists for their comments during this first hour. Again, in our second hour, we will be talking all together, and not all at once, but all together. And we'll be tackling each of the issues that we've just laid out, and we'll allow each other to comment on each one of those. So definitely stay tuned for the second hour. It's going to be a really firecracker, probably one of our best. So we're going to go to a quick commercial break. When we get back, again, we'll be doing that. All of us will be discussing the issues that we've just laid out, so you're not going to want to miss it. So stay tuned.